Chapter 4, An Indian Ritual. The days passed by happily at the cafe. One day a young Native American spoke with them between sets and began discussing Native American religion, ritual, and folklore. Steve praised the Indians' roots and culture, then added, "It's interesting that the Indian war shields didn't serve to protect, but were mostly symbolic. The mandala of the Eastern religions isn't like a protective shield against a real foe, either. It seems that the movements of today's young people are also largely symbolic. Whether we fight psychologically or physically, we always die fighting. I'm worried something's going to happen to me. I have no shield of protection. It's like how Jesus knew he was going to the cross. Sometimes I feel so unshielded I'm afraid the same thing will happen to me, mentally or physically. I may look well-seasoned, but I'm really pretty naive." "I know what you mean. Sometimes I fear the trickster, too," agreed the young man. "There's going to be a peyote ritual next week, and I'll be initiated into the tribe as a brave. The next morning, I'll be given the name Little Bird. Would you like to come? All of you are welcome." Steve turned to Maria and raised his eyebrows in question. She had heard of peyote, that it erases the ego and connects one with the Godhead. In Colombia, she had once experimented with a psychedelic with a friend, but had been barely aware of the drug's effect. Disappointed with that experience, she wanted to know what peyote was like, though she felt she might be too weak to face such an experience. Her doll-like Spanish ego said no, but her curiosity urged yes. She hesitated, pretending a reservation she did not possess, before finally nodding assent. "You two can go," John said, "but I won't. Those days are over for me." There was no trace of anger or alienation in his voice. When the day of the ceremony arrived, Steve and Maria took a bus to the ruins of an old Indian village where the tribe held its ceremonies. The initiation ritual was complicated. A friend of the young man who would be named Little Bird had drawn sand paintings for the all-night ritual. The centerpiece bore a somewhat Christian motif, which included the crescent moon that Mother Mary is always pictured within. The sun set, and to the beat of drums and song, the group chewed peyote mixed with lemon. Though it went against ritual, soda water was drunk to wash away the bitterness. They chewed slowly while listening to chant. There was no formal structure to eating peyote, and social graces took no part in the ritual. Their laissez-faire behavior lacked propriety. The participants were aware that their egos would soon disappear, leaving their spiritual cups to stand empty. Already, Steve's and Maria's minds were vacant of comprehension. Neither had been mentored in the dangers of the ritual they were participating in. They wanted to know why it was possible to meet God through peyote, and to do so they would have to lose their egos. They did not see that they needed their fragile egos to conduct their lives and develop their livelihood. When they both started to dissolve into pure collective awareness, Maria doubted her sanity for a moment. Although she was not a strong soul, she possessed enough self-knowledge to understand that releasing her ego wasn't the ultimate answer to enlightenment, so she held on to herself. She questioned her sanity because she felt nearly hysterical as she tried to identify with the nothingness that embodied her, what Zen masters call Satori. She drank an herbal tea that was given to her to soothe what was left of her ego. She contemplated the teacup she drank from, remembering a story that Steve had told about how he had stolen a rare tea set from his family when he had left home. He had pawned it for money, but later, because he loved the tea set so, he bought it back. Later on, when both of them were together, he told the story to a friend of theirs who had been a Jesus freak. The friend, in turn, had told Steve about the story of Benjamin, who had been framed by Joseph for stealing a cup. She felt those teacups symbolized their lives together. By recovering the cups, they had reclaimed their lives. She said to herself, "I can live without ego, but not without a body, or a soul for that matter." The cups were a symbol for the family unit and mutual unity, like the pieces of the tea set itself. "It doesn't matter if the cups are empty or full," she thought, "just to have them is the key." The teacup full of drink is the ego, and the egolessness is one empty of tea. Right now, my mind is empty of all identity except that of God. But isn't it true that fullness in God means your cup runneth over? Shouldn't it be that to have a full ego is the true gift of God, rather than to have no self? But God is infinite and powerful. He doesn't consider his body a fragile tea set like us, or whether it is empty or full. He's jealous because he is made of spirit and we are flesh. He swings his fists. What if there was an infinite Maria instead of an infinite God, and God was small like a cup? Wouldn't that be a paradox? It isn't right to steal a tea set, but it is minuscule compared to stealing away somebody's mind and physical welfare, leaving them bereft of even the most meager of social positions. Why does the infinite seem so meager? She looked at the mandala that the Indian had drawn and at the crescent moon with the simple image of Mother Mary, the epitome of motherhood. Oneness is considered only relative to God or deity, which is depicted many times in the center of a mandala or meditation device, whereas Mother Mary in the center of the sand painting is only centrally the symbol of motherhood, not centrally oneness. So it seemed odd to her that they had Mother Mary in the center rather than having some image that related to the Great Spirit or Godhead. She didn't understand why oneness was relative only to God when Mother Mary was a mundane material image of motherhood, the bringer of life. If that mandala was supposed to be the center of being, why aren't we all one in Mother Mary rather than God? She told Steve what she was thinking. Steve, who was more introverted and weak in his sense of self than Maria, said that he found no sustenance from the ego and didn't see that the Godhead was playing an ego game with him. Maria said, "Don't you see? This is really like a hunter of our egos, like killing a deer. It is really impish and hysterical to want an egoless identity with God. It is like a saccharin high. Anyone can consume saccharin, and any effects from it are simply illusion." She said it not because she really believed that there was something wrong with the non-ego. She was just trying to rationalize. Steve, in his innocence of the material meaning of life, couldn't understand Maria's point that it is unequal to put a higher value on an acquisitive God who, through material and spiritual means, makes foreign peoples surrender their egos to him. Non-ego gave him a fragile but temporary natural poise that would only last as long as the peyote trip. He enjoyed boasting for a few hours about feeling perfect after living such hard times on the streets. Life was so confusing. For this reason, his normal sense of self was neurotically and ascetically small, so his only source of comfort was destroying his ego. He lacked the scruples that would have taught him how to avoid destructive behavior like destroying the ego, because scruples are the mental structures that one uses to plot out one's formative years and material life. He wasn't very good at avoiding regrettable experiences. No matter how illogical his new lifestyles were, they seemed legitimate. He couldn't see that he was barely making it. With his paltry understanding of the material world, reality was far, far from him at that moment. All of a sudden, Maria started crying. "This is not right. We all have natural grace as unambiguous guides, interacting with each other in unique ways. Demanding, violent, uncompromising egos are bad, but compassionate egos are very important. You know that prayer, 'Mother Mary, full of grace, blessed is the fruit of thy womb'? Greatness is born from the inspiration of the ego as well as the Godhead. I just don't know who I'm going to be in life. I'm a runaway, a musician, and barely know what to do with myself," she said, nearly hysterical. Steve vaguely understood what she was saying, but he knew even less than she what he should do with his life. He didn't comprehend the ironic and impish denial of the egoless spirit, or of any meaning in logic and reason. He could only see logic and reason as limitations that were put upon him. It was understandable why he was in a state of rebellion against the egotistical, materialistic people of the world. He didn't see the value of the ego as a Hermes of God. He didn't think he would ever fall from his introverted spiritual righteousness because he couldn't foresee how his neurotic introversion would one day be his downfall. He couldn't fathom how it might turn into delusional or psychotic introversion, nor did he understand that he would need more than simple skills to make money. In his detached state, Steve contemplated his non-ego and thought about the words of the Hindu Upanishads, which speak of God as Atman and the necessity to surrender yourself and everything you have to Atman, the Godhead. He puzzled deeply over those tenets. Because he wrote poetry and music, he sometimes thought in rhymes. He considered the word Upanishad like a tad. He mumbled and thought how sad he was, even in his synthetic bliss. He thought that those two words together, tad and sad, were ironic and paradoxical. If man were to surrender, he only had a tad of the experience that made up the whole of life. Consequently, he would assume the bliss of abandonment was sadness, not happiness. He knew he was playing with words, but his mind couldn't resist. He said to Maria, "You've read some of the Upanishads about surrendering to Atman. Supposedly you receive everything through Atman even though you have nothing. But isn't the Upanishads only a tad of the truth? You're supposed to be happy if you have nothing, but aren't you really sad? And ego death isn't exactly happy. It doesn't seem to be bliss, but isn't it also a strange form of sadness?" Sometimes Steve babbled because of his confusion, and though he still made some sense as he dodged madness, he was a tad bit off. Maria said, "You're so innocent and silly with your little ego. You're like one of those silly Indian gurus." "Om," she chanted, giggling. In the morning they came down from their high and watched the sun come up. Maria, her little ego now restored, was a little more conceptual than Steve was. She was, however, still unaware of her significance and purpose in life beyond enjoyment of being a good person. She was unaware of the fall she might set herself up for while searching for enlightenment. To them both, life was one step above a dream. She didn't know what regular people did. As she awoke to normality that morning, she considered new views of reality and contemplated deep visions that would develop as she grew older. There are hysterical believers in God, both left and right, she knew, just as there are hysterical spiritualists, and there are snobbish leftist spiritualists. And there are also purely pleasure-oriented leftists. At the moment, however, such theories were only the seeds of ideas. She leaned more to her leftist seditious side and possessed an immature attachment to her peyote experience. She felt proud that she had come down off the throne of her ego, but she was equally proud that she had seen through it and knew that people aren't weak puppets to be thrown around by God. Rather, people were kings and queens to be revered. She thought, "If I ever run a big company or a city, I shouldn't be a hypocrite or puppeteer my followers' egos or make them run around performing selfless duties for me." Basically, those were only imaginative fantasies she entertained as her mind shuttled between innocence and boasting and the concept of the wickedness of total power, left or right. She tried to fathom the depth of her ignorance of the corrupt nature of the disparagement of the ego, which drug takers worshipped. She considered but hadn't discovered the true integrity of the small but unique corporeal self, the ego. It seemed all innocence and ignorance to her. She was young and life was a lark. Although they were now back to normal and their full egos had returned, they hadn't really developed their scruples. Restating what they had experienced, they had only a tad bit more understanding of what would become of them. Life goals hadn't materialized out of their carefree attitudes. Although they were rebellious, they were also developing some temperance towards drugs, each wary enough to stay away from narcotics.